Good evening and welcome to Swords in Space Radio. I'm your host, Nicholas Wansbutter, and this evening I'm joined by Mark Ratush, who listeners may remember from our inaugural show on the Canticle for Leibowitz. Although tonight we'll be talking about another novel that's certainly considered a classic in science fiction circles, and in fact the Science Fiction Writers of America apparently consider this the best of all time, Nightfall by Isaac Asimov and Robert Silverberg. The music you just heard is from Handel's Messiah, For Behold, Darkness Shall Cover the Earth, which I thought was a particularly fitting song for this particular show, given the overarching theme of the Nightfall novel, which is about a planet that is located in a solar system, the planet Kalgash, which contains six suns, which keep the planet continuously illuminated, the entire planet continuously illuminated at all times, such that darkness is unknown to the inhabitants of that planet. And also sort of the stars are unknown to them, and then the novel tells the story of what happens when all but one of the stars are on one side of the planet and a moon that they didn't realize they had eclipses the last one. Now, just before we launch into our discussion, perhaps a quick rundown of the characters. We'll be discussing them. Now, the characters all have numbers for last names instead of last names. I frankly can't remember the numbers, but and Mark, jump in and help me if I forget any of the characters. But the main ones would be there's Sheeran, who's a kind of typical academic, overweight psychologist, expert in the effect of darkness upon the human psyche. You've got Bine, who's a professor of astronomy and who is the protege of Althor, who is a living legend in astronomy who had come up with a universal theory of movement of the celestial bodies. There's Theramon, who is a journalist and good friend of Bine. There's Sapphira, who's a archaeologist and kind of very independent-minded woman character. And then there's Philemon, who's one of the higher-ups in a religious organization called the Apostles of Flame, who are one of the other ones predicting the coming of Nightfall on Kalgash, the other group being this mishmash of scientists who in various different ways come to the belief that's going to befall the planet. So I think that covers all the main characters. Anyone that you think I missed that's worth mentioning?
No, I think I'll essentially have some few minor ones on the side, but in terms of the story progression from both parts of the novel, that more or less covers it, and certainly we can bring up any other individuals as it impacts our discussion.
Right. Now, without trying to avoid spoilers, because this is one of the good works that we're covering, and as listeners will know, I have no qualms about giving spoilers aplenty on works that I don't like, but this one I think is worth reading. But it's basically divided into three parts: the lead up to Nightfall and what happens when that event occurs, and then kind of the aftermath. And in the lead up, it's as these scientists discover in their various ways. The archaeologist discovers evidence that there'd been some sort of fiery cataclysm a number of times through history and well into the prehistory, because they thought that their civilization was only about 2,000 years old, and then she discovers that previously there'd been, you know, up to 10,000 years previously there'd been civilizations that every 2,000 years have been wiped out. And then this kind of dovetails with some research that Binet is doing, where he determines that the universal theory of his scientific father figure isn't right, because the movement of the suns aren't quite matching up. And then they determine that there must be another body, which I took to be a moon, that they didn't know about. And then the interactions, as they come together, and then Theramon's involvement as a journalist in that. So lots of interesting things that we can discuss about this film. But before we jump into that, of course, I should remind our listeners that you can find Swords and Space on the web at www.swordsandspace.com. And I encourage you to like us on Facebook at facebook.com/swordsandspace, all one word, and thereby be able to keep up to date. This radio program is part of the AMDG radio network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/AMDG. And if you use iTunes, I believe we're available. All AMDG shows are available for download on iTunes. So if you can just go on iTunes and search Swords in Space, you should be able to find us. So the going into the work itself a bit, perhaps we'll start off, Mark, with a question I asked you in relation to Canticle for Leibowitz. In your view, what makes this a classic science fiction novel?
Well, and again, for those listeners who don't know, originally this was written as a short story by Asimov in the early 1940s, and eventually it got expanded into a novel. The short story in itself more or less covers everything up until essentially Nightfall, and basically with the help of Silverberg, we find out what happens afterwards. So it's a lot more fleshed out in terms of the characters, in terms of the actual planet names, and in terms of the plot. So it works a lot better as a novel than a short story. But why I think it's classic as a psychological thriller, and just sort of an interesting concept that's putting the reader into a mind of an alien society, and there's even a little blurb that said you can start substituting certain names, but he wants to sort of keep it that alien flavor, even though we have that sense of familiarity while we read it. This is a planet that, again, as Nicholas has pointed out, has never experienced night. It is constantly light, so the whole question of evolution, we won't bother that. Anyway, you're born into an environment, you are built in psychologically, hardwired for that, and we know that something's going to basically happen, and it's sort of following that psychological progression from, first from the psychologist, what does the darkness do, and then the archaeological discoveries by Seferin figuring, uh-oh, and then we go to the astronomer, Althor and Binet, and realize, there's something coming up. And it's sort of, I like the first part, it's sort of it's suspenseful. And it's always, even to reread, you know what's coming, it's how it's developing, and how these different people are sort of reacting to it in their own irrational and sort of irrational ways. I think it's fairly well written in terms of plot, in terms of characters. I think the second part is weak. I still find the whole Twilight Inn, and there's a lot of stuff, a lot of things can change. People are sort of out of character, but of course, considering what actually happens, maybe that's not so all that far-fetched. But I think it just is a lot of unique characters, something that really hasn't been tackled before, or really that well since today. So it gives you that sense of, alien fascination. It does feel like an alien world, even though there's a lot of similarities. And the fact that it requires us as the reader to try to wrap around the head that here is a planet very completely like on our own. I mean, certainly we visit all these different types of planets within fantasy and science fiction. Tatooine, yeah, fine, it's got two suns, Vulcan, and all these different places. But this is the first time, really, that we've sort of bumped into one that's got Zippo darkness only at a certain period. And for someone coming up to that, and sort of they get the psychological reaction, physical reaction, mental reaction, religious reaction, scientific reaction of hitting something you absolutely don't know. You sort of know what's coming, but you really don't know what's coming, and sort of people's reaction to that. I think that's what really makes it sort of a good psychological science fiction type novel.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. It is, it's something that hasn't really been done before or since, and it was very well done. I thought they did an excellent job of capturing this alien world, as you say. Although beyond the sunlight, I didn't find the world building to be particularly impressive beyond that. Maybe they didn't feel the need to go further in the world building, but you're left kind of with question marks about what the state of the planet of Kalgash really is.
Indeed. I mean, you sort of get a few things thrown in terms of the type of government. Yeah, it's very true. It's not very fleshed out. And I was sort of from a technological point of view, you're only making these discoveries at this point in your history. You're only making these particular discoveries, the archaeological ones for starters, the astronomical ones and the astrophysical ones, only this particularly late when we take a look at Earth history. And we see that we have Copernicus, Kepler, Ptolemy. I mean, that we're going back hundreds and hundreds of years. But then again, maybe to play the devil's advocate, we do have Einstein, and this theory is relatively, and that's quote unquote still fairly recent.
Right.
Technologically, we have vehicles and everything else that can always fly around and from continent to continent, so we can sort of picture that. Yet, from a scientific point, from the astronomical point of view, though, it seems very, very primitive. Of course, there's probably no reason for a space program because they don't believe, again, without turning to any space, they don't believe there's anything else other than six suns, and that's it. That's their entire universe. So extremely limited, very close-minded, very much like an atheist mind, but anyway, that's my pot shot there. so I can see why there wouldn't be any more in terms of exploration. I guess the need would not be perceived because they can't really see too much.
Yeah, although one thing that was really left out there, especially when you start getting into the more post-apocalyptic phase, I was left wondering, well, where is the military, and where are there no police?
Exactly. There's a lot of stuff like that that's left out. You kind of wonder. Yes, you hear provisional government and everything else. I don't think it detracts too much, but it does make you wonder. You'd have that kind of a complete collapse because they would be major elements to fill that power vacuum, certainly when we think of the states and the military.
I mean, there's one throwaway quote some point in the novel near the end where they make a mention about how they had done away with wars, which, you know, so it's a bit of this Star Trek, you know, false utopian view of the future, that if only we can achieve this atheist socialist paradise, there will be no more war in the world, which is, you know, kind of nonsense. But I think they do get away with it in this work because, as you say, it's more of a psychological thriller, so those things aren't integral to the plot, and it's fairly easy to overlook them.
Oh, indeed. But I do agree with your point where the fact is, yes, we overcome war well. Considering the type of society and how easy it's going to be to break down, that was a very weak. I mean, you should be actually, people should be killing. Sure, maybe you just don't care. Seems like a very pretty sedate bunch. It's okay, we got this, we got that. Nobody listens to the government. Everyone does this. Everyone does what they want. We just sort of putz along until basically, you know what, hits the fan, and then all of a sudden, well, they're a goodbye Kalgash.
Yeah. Although, now, going to the characters, and I think part of the reason, no doubt, that the characters seem quite realistic for the most part, I have a bit of an issue with Saphira, but we'll go back to her in a moment. I think overall the characters are quite well done, and maybe it's partly because they're almost all university professors or university people, and Asimov himself was a university professor. And, you know, they often say, write what you know. So I guess he was writing a bit of what he knew with the characters.
Oh, indeed. I found Sheeran to be actually quite likable. Very, just sort of your, I mean, I've actually met professors like that. Very more likable, easy to get along with, knows his stuff. Doesn't come across as arrogant and everything else. Of course, you always had a bad lawyer in there, so I was sort of thinking of you.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what universe, doesn't matter what planet, lawyers are always rotten.
Yeah.
So something to work on, science fiction people. Take a look at, I mean, Binet, something not objectionable. Saphira, I found as a character, on the whole, to be fairly quite objectionable. And what happens here into the second part is almost, I mean, it's almost completely out of character. I think that really didn't work for me in terms of what happens,
what she decides
to do.
Well, because Saphira, I mean, and I thought she was one of the weak points of the book. Like, it was almost like a female Indiana Jones. Like, you know, she's the archaeologist who's, like, out in the field. And, I thought it was almost to the point of distasteful, like, how often Asimov seemed to feel the need to talk about how athletic she was. And, like, he mentions her legs pretty much every time she's moving anywhere. He has to mention her strong legs as she's walking here or walking there.
Exactly. I'm thinking Angelina Jolie, Tomb Raider type. You're smart, you're intelligent. Yes, and the whole thing running across the quad in the rain without any clothes on. Okay, Asimov, you've got something going on here.
Which I don't know about you. You've done even more university than I have, but in my six years of university life, I never encountered any professors like that.
Never that good looking. Nope. to be honest. And again, I mean, I can understand from a stereotypical because there are some pretty strident feminist types out there, and then certainly it's gotten worse since both of us have left. Our university and postgraduate studies, but in terms of actual someone being that good looking, that's more or less, that's really a carbon cutty Hollywood Angelina Jolie female Indiana Jones type character.
Yeah.
Just, I can understand someone being me. It just doesn't happen.
So that was a bit disappointing, and it kind of struck me as a bit of fantasy fulfillment rather than fantasy fiction or science fiction. Then, as you say, completely out of character behavior in the third part of the book, where she's this strong, independent, feminist woman. She basically despises men, doesn't need anyone, let alone a man, and then she becomes the love interest for the cocky, annoying, of course, it had to be the cocky, you know, journalist is the one that she ends up falling for, which, I mean, I liked Saruman as a character, but I just thought it was rather iffy that he somehow wins Saphira over.
Well, exactly. That's why I found the second part, basically Daylight, to be the weakest part of the trilogy. I mean, fine, it'd be rather that everyone basically went nuts would be a lot better. All of a sudden, she starts, oh, yes, and amorous. But I'm certainly glad that Theremin got his humble pie after all that. But unfortunately, how that developed and the relationship they get into and the organization, without making any spoilers to get into, that was for me, that's like, usually when I reread it or listen to it, I usually stop at a certain point because I think, yeah, this is where it gets really weak. It falls apart.
Yeah.
But up until a certain point, it's great, but then I do find it gets weak.
Yeah, but, I mean, those complaints aside, I think on the whole it's still a strong and very, very interesting novel. And I think when we get into some of the themes that are really fascinating and thought-provoking, which is what I think is what makes it so good, I guess you don't need or expect perfect characters in a science fiction if it delivers the goods in terms of some thought and ideas. But before we get into that, rating, who would you, what age level, maturity level would you recommend read this novel?
Well, as we're basically broadcasting to a traditional Catholic audience, I mean, there is essentially, okay, folks, there's no sex in there, thank God. There is talk, there is, quote, contract mate. There is actually mentioned both a marriage and contract. So we have sort of different terms floating back and forth for the same thing. There is monogamy, which is a good thing. So I think from that point of view, apart from sort of a couple iffy things about, quote-unquote, a character running around with nothing on in water, and sort of the one scene in the second half of the book where there's, again, like his wish fulfillment on Asimov's part, I guess.
Yeah.
I would probably, PG, I mean, you should be 15 to 16. You should be an older, more mature reader. Otherwise, you're really not going to enjoy the book.
Yeah, because
it is more of a psychological, simply because what the book is trying to portray. It's simply not bang them up, shoot them up. It's not a barbarian thing where people are getting slaughtered left and right, and it's not a God-forbidden sex romp. It's more a cycle. Look into the mind of the people on how people react to a situation that is completely alien, completely foreign to them, and they are not completely prepared for or have been created for, and then to see that reaction. Requires a bit more maturity level on a reader's for a reader.
Well, it's psychological, but there's also a fair bit of philosophical.
Oh yes, there's philosophical things.
So that would be, I would agree with you that I don't think it's it's not a question of needing to be a bit older necessarily because of violence or other quote adult unquote content, but I think it's better to have an older teenager just to fully appreciate it. So PG reading, rating, I would tend to agree. And if you were to give it out of 5 stars,
I would say
quantify the goodness.
The goodness, In terms of an overall story, taking account of the weakness, I think I would give it 4 out of 5. I mean, it's very hard to find a perfect novel. But again, this is one I go back to over and over again. It's one of my favorite rereads, like 1984 and Lord of the Rings, Tolkien material. Because there is that strong writing and that whole psychological development, and just sort of to get into these people's head and realize, yep, there's something's coming, and not a thing you can do about it, and just to watch what is going to happen to these people and how they react. So for that, definitely the 4 out of 5 stars, despite the weak parts and despite a few other things, again, the world building. But I don't find they got in as much in a way. They certainly could have interfered a lot more. It could have been a bit better. But it didn't take away from sort of the general, the general, I guess, plot of the book, essentially. Okay, how are these people going to react?
I'm maybe a bit tougher. I tend to only reserve my 4s and 5s for the best works, but I don't think I'm much off. I'd give it a solid 3.5, which for me is probably most people's 4 out of 5 stars. I'll just do the show identification before we move on to kind of the real meat of our discussion. For anyone who's just joining us, you're listening to Swords in Space on the AMDG radio network. I'm your host, Nicholas Wandsbutter, with the guest, Mark Ratush, and tonight we are discussing Isaac Asimov and Robert Silverberg's novel Nightfall. Now, we've talked about the psychological thriller aspect, and I was bringing up the philosophical aspect near the end there, and one of the really clearly overriding themes of the work is this, what I would call a false dichotomy that Asimov sets up between reason and science on the one hand and religion on the other, because the main kind of antagonists of the work are the apostles of flame that I mentioned, who Interestingly, they have somewhat the same goal as the scientists. Their goal is to make people aware that this nightfall is going to happen and try to prepare them, but they're portrayed as these kind of wild-eyed, frothing at the mouth, religious zealots who... they're portrayed as totally puritanical. I mean, I don't know whether that's what they actually are or... No,
I think that is a correct perception. I remember Theremon discussing, I mean, drink is evil, everything is evil, people are just absolute godless sinners. Unfortunately, you're getting all this stuff thrown out, but it's almost like stereotypical. There's nothing really underpinning anything. Yes, they're preparing for it. Obviously, they've been around for a while. But the whole religious sense really doesn't tie in with the whole apocalyptic theme. Again, because, of course, Asimov really doesn't know what I think he's talking about. A lot of sense. There's a lot of emotion there, probably a lot of anger there. So
yeah.
There's a lot of inconsistency in terms, okay, these are the Paws of Flame, this is what they stand for. So, yeah, okay, fine, they are a pure catatonical bunch, but it's not like the other side is rational either, which I'm sure you will bring up here.
and we'll get to that, but just, you know, a bit more of how Asimov's tries to set up this dichotomy. I mean, like, it's not just that they're zealots. I mean, they're anti-scientific zealots. Like, there's a scene where they're outraged that the scientists have a natural explanation for the nightfall, and therefore they want to destroy all the scientific instruments because this is a blasphemy to them. That, you know, it seems like they're really the stereotypical, anti- religious, you know, like, oh, religious people, you know, they can't accept reason, or that, you know, that there's somehow this opposition between reason and faith.
Well, exactly. Well, again, but considering who's writing it, coming from that bias, it is not surprising that essentially fundamentalist, anti-rational. And as, of course, we listen in traditional Catholics, does faith and reason go together? If it wasn't, as we know, if it wasn't the Catholic Church, we wouldn't have produced the scientists. We wouldn't have produced, Western civilization would not exist, basically.
Yeah.
It is a weakness on that part. I mean, I can understand where they more or less want to destroy. I'm thinking, as we sort of flip back to Canticle of Leibowitz, the great simplification, that same theme, we want to destroy all these intellectuals. These are the buggers who are getting us into this trouble in the first place. They're trying to write a natural explanation. They're being, of course, ridiculed by the newspapers, so that's a bit of a twist. But nobody believes them anyway, but they want it to be destroyed. So next time, for this next 2049 period, we're only going to listen to this one particular person. We're seeing at least that, I saw that theme basically crop up. It's that real anti-intellectual mentality, and again, how it's unfortunately has to be again dumped on quote the religious people unquote.
Yeah,
I mean, I would have loved to see the religion developed a lot more in this one. I mean, you have the pantheon of the gods. Obviously, it's sort of a more maybe your Greco-Roman. You have a few bunch, but we don't really hear too much about it. Other than that, we're sinners. So I can see what Asimov's playing with, what he's struggling with himself.
Right, but yeah, I mean, he takes it, like, he goes whole hog on the thing. Like, there's one quote that I bookmarked for myself, page 346 of the Kindle version of Nightfall, that they're talking about how Theremon is speaking with Sephira about how the people are now trying to kill anyone, like, university people. So they say, Sephira says, they blame Athor, Bina, and company for everything that's happened. It's the old hatred of the intellectual that crops up whenever medieval emotions start surfacing. I mean, I just have to laugh at that line. I mean, it's so blatant. It's almost like author intrusion into the story, but it's also so completely wrong. I mean, as we were discussing during the pre-show, like, you know, Dr. Asimov, you wouldn't have even been a professor at a university if it wasn't for, quote, medieval emotions, unquote, because the medieval Catholics are the ones who created universities.
Well, exactly. And that, from from anyone who's writing, take the time to study history. I know there's going to be biases no matter where you're coming from. I would hope that we as traditional Catholic listeners and writers, the ones of us who are, would try to factor that in. Yes, there's something certainly we're weak upon, but we're going to realize that. And when you see it in others, how are we supposed to take you then seriously as a writer and everything else if you keep coming up with essentially this basic nonsense? I mean, if that's what you're trying to push through a story, it's not going to work. I mean, it's unfortunately for those of us who know a bit more about the novel and everything else, have read it, I guess sort of not coming to the first time, it does irk. But again, keeping in mind the mindset of the person who's writing it, yeah, I'm not surprised. And then,
yeah, well, and most people believe that too. I mean, that's how he can get away with it, because unfortunately, unless you seriously study medieval history in a university context or getting those more serious books, if you're just going with popular medieval history, most people would share that view, because that's what, quote, popular, unquote, history would have us believe, that the Middle Ages was some dark age and, you know, they just burned anyone with any brains at the stake back then, and there was no learning, and to the contrary, learning and the faith went hand in hand. And that's why I go back to the Canticle for Leibowitz, which has the completely contrary depiction of science and faith to what Nightfall does, because in Canticle for Leibowitz, it's the religious folk who have preserved the knowledge by way of the Albertian order of St. Leibowitz.
Oh, indeed. And in one sense, we also have and the funny thing here is that the Apostles of Flame have records that the quote-unquote scientific community doesn't have, and yet they're still portrayed as the baddies.
It's odd. Yeah, it is odd. And I'm going to be surprised here. We're going to have like a convergence of faith and science, where the science is proving what the faith says, when the scientists discover, wait a minute, Nightfall is going to come. Maybe the Apostles of Flame aren't so crazy after all.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but then he takes it the other way and has the Apostles of Flame be outraged that they've put a scientific explanation to the Nightfall.
So yeah, that's why sort of these little dichotomies. Again, it makes for an interesting read, but it sort of shows basically the hypocrisy of both, because certainly as Catholics we're not puritanical fundamentalists, yeah, so they're wrong. But guess what? You scientists are absolutely no better.
Yeah.
So if Asimov is trying to show science better, guess what? Big fail.
Yeah. Although I suppose in Asimov's defense, he lived in the United States. The United States was founded by Puritans, really.
Yes, exactly.
Rock and all that. So, maybe this is a bit of a reaction to certain flavors of Protestantism that are especially predominant in the United States, because some of them do seem to adhere to this dichotomy that there's an opposition between faith and reason.
Yeah, so I think he's probably picking up on that. So that, again, are some of the more fundamentalist strains. And perhaps he would have been exposed to that. But again, that's sort of, when you don't have a sort of a larger view of sort of the religious experience of the world, but again, what can you expect from an atheist in that respect? If you're going to be an honest and try to be, trying to call them rational is probably also rather silly. But trying to be honest and honest is probably about the best word.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of trying to approach the subject material, but unfortunately, we don't get that.
Right. But and that was an interesting thing for me. I haven't read a lot of Asimov. I've read the Foundation trilogy, and that was a long time ago, so maybe I just missed it. But there seemed almost to be like an anger in the way he treated religious people here. Like, what? It was that, do you know, was Isaac Asimov a really militant atheist, or am I misreading?
Well, from some of the quotes I read, is I wanted to find out a bit more in terms of his backgrounds, and certainly why he wasn't a believer. Obviously, of Jewish background and origin, which he put a lot of credence and faith to being sort of the quote cultural Jew unquote. But he said, emotionally, I'm an atheist. So that should start ringing bells off right there. Because essentially that is what atheism comes down. It's an emotional reaction, something I don't like, something that's been pushed out. It is not rational. And it is probably is this hatred and this emotion and vitriol being poured out against the apostles of flame and towards basically, I would say, religious people. So
in that sense,
I'm really glad the scientists did get their comeuppance, that everything did get smashed, because at least it evens out the playing field a bit.
Yeah, because the apostles of flame are pretty much, they're the only religious characters in the novel. Everyone else are atheists, really.
Oh, indeed. It doesn't seem like no one else got
sense. Or they're just kind of hypocritical, like, you know, Colonel Mustard, you know, High Church Anglican, you know, we go for the ceremonies on Sunday, but it has nothing to do with our lives. That seems to be, it's either your apostles of flame, you're kind of that hypocritical, you know, just for appearances, social type of religion, or you're an enlightened atheist. Those are the only really views you see of characters in the novel.
Unfortunately, yeah. But again, considering where it's from, again, not surprising. So again, I sort of take a look at more sort of the psychological impact, and then you have to take these other little rantings and everything else is, okay, obviously we're getting too much of the bias of the sort of author coming in. And it sort of be worse if we sort of came in and started canonizing everybody, everyone was sort of great, although we'd be far more justified because it's more rational oriented to do something like that.
Right. Well, I don't want to flog a dead horse, and there is lots other interesting to discuss about the novel. And I think an area I personally, maybe we'll differ a bit on this, because you're saying you don't like the second half of the novel as much. I thought, as a post-apocalyptic work, I thought it was pretty well done, and I I don't know, liked is perhaps the wrong word, because it's a pretty terrible reality that is in play after the nightfall. But I thought it was well done, and I thought it was maybe unwittingly a very accurate rendition and kind of condemnation of modern society, of how far it could slip with just a relatively minor natural disaster, just having the lights turned off.
Well, that's true. I mean, from the apocalypse end, to see everything actually collapse, and we see the absolute total collapse, considering, again, as we mentioned in the beginning of the program, we have a people, when you're, and I'm just trying to think of something, as I was sort of discussed prior to the show, how we, in this earth, can come up with something comparable in terms of an experience, of an apocalyptic experience. I'm thinking, okay, you're used to this. You don't know the stars exist. This is your total universe. Everything you know comes to an absolute end when the stars come out. I mean, realize, oh my, it just blows away the very fragile psyche of these individuals. Your whole mental state, and just the fact the way you're basically built, and the fact that you're doomed to repeat it over and over and over and over. So, which is sort of actually quite depressing when you sort of look at it, but again, not surprising considering where the writing's coming from. No, I thought it was pretty good. Everything does fall into chaos, because in the sense that it's almost, quote, human nature. When things fall to pieces, you are going to get these types of groups. You're going to get some good individuals. But just I'm always trying to think, what would we have that we could sort of compare to that
you could almost
it's difficult.
The one thing I thought of is I just think of Dr. David Allen White, who recently retired from being a professor of literature and English at the American Naval Academy down in Virginia there. You know, he says, you know, he thinks his quote crackpot theory unquote, as he calls it, that, you know, one day all the electricity might go out on the whole planet, I mean, that still wouldn't rise to the level of trauma that I think the people experience in the Nightfall novel, but it would be something that would completely turn our world upside down if all of a sudden every electronic device that we've become so reliant upon in the whole world ceased to function, and the world
would. Oh, you would have. It would be the apocalypse of. Yeah, it would be the apocalypse of one sort. The only other thing I could really think of is sort of the second coming. Okay, then all of a sudden it's, oh boy. Then that really is sort of the apocalypse. I mean, that is
yeah.
it.
Yeah, although, yeah that's that something most different. But I thought it was well done in terms of like seeing like total societal breakdown, how people might react to that. You've got cropping up kind of little warlords almost, or like strong men in certain locales taking charge, and you've got the you know various bandits and whatnot, and of course, well, the great majority of people that are just stark raving mad after seeing the stars.
Oh, indeed. I mean, I think it does accurately portray sort of that complete breakdown, and we can sort of see parallels here. I mean, it doesn't. I'm just sort of thinking the flooding in Katrina, and it doesn't take much for social breakdown on this planet. So
yeah.
I think that's right. You start losing your electronics, you lose this, you lose it. And, of course,
yeah.
this is an absolutely world-changing event.
Yeah,
worldwide.
I mean, that's, yeah. Imagine
exactly.
Imagine Katrina in every single city on the whole planet in one day.
Then you would probably have something very close to with Nightfall. Here, probably, and also close would also be dependent on where we are, and again, we don't really get into the great distinction of cultures and countries on this particular planet. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in some places, it would be a bloodbath, I'm thinking, in some places in the States. In other places, we're going to be probably be sedate and quiet and sort of just be Canadian about it. Sorry, all you Canadians out there.
Well, we're both Canadian,
we don't get,
for those who don't know.
Yeah, so there we go.
But, I mean, I was, at one point, I was thinking almost a little bit of discussions we've had in the past about, in Serenity, the film and the Reavers versus the people who all just kind of lay down and die, and how we thought that was kind of an accurate extrapolation of what might happen in modern society if you have, again, something like worldwide Hurricane Katrina. And he has a bit of that in this as well, I thought, too. You know, you've got some people who are just roving around predators upon man, and then you've got a lot of people who are just kind of huddled in these kind of refugee camps, kind of lost, you know, without aim, just kind of doing whatever these strong men tell them.
Oh, exactly. I think once you strip the veneer off of civilization, we will see the wolves versus the sheep.
Yeah.
And I think we see that very much in this novel. And then it's interesting to see, at least for me, for what happens to sort of happen, the individual characters.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been nice to see a few more of the major characters, what would happen to them, rather than being sort of just shuffled off in the distance. But so
yeah.
that was just, I would say, a teen sense disappointing in that. But in terms of the actual collapse, I definitely can see it happening.
Yeah,
I would have loved to have found out a bit about
yeah,
more of how they would, if some of the people would have made it to that park. But
yeah.
again,
no,
unless
I
you want a longer book.
I thought it was well portrayed, but again, the irony there, I think, is when you say about stripping the veneer off civilization. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, he's talking about medieval emotions and that. Well, but you know, if you go back to the Middle Ages, you know, they had no police force back then. They, you know, the government was like, you know, I mean, it wasn't anarchy. I mean, you had feudalism, obviously, but really, feudalism isn't what most modern people think of it. I mean, compared to the modern state. It was near anarchy that people lived in Middle Ages, yet they didn't have complete societal breakdown. So that's a bit of the irony of, you know, his talking about, you know, faith versus reason. Well, but the reason they didn't have near anarchy is because people then were bound together by faith, but also by familial bonds and cultural bonds and, you know, tradition and things like that.
Well, indeed, that is essentially what kept everything more or less together, and it's something we don't have again in the 21st century, and certainly we did not have on this fictional planet of Kalgash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if that's why I said might have been kind of a subconsciously accurate portrayal of things, because I don't know that Asimov would have been thinking of that. And there doesn't seem to be, I mean, given kind of the lack of world building in terms of any depiction of a real culture or traditions or things like that, you don't get the sense that that really was on his mind when he was writing the work.
No. I think it's very much the psychological aspect certainly comes up, and everything else is perhaps a bit more incidental, or sort of, as with anything, it sort of just leaks through. It just leaks through.
We're nearing the end of our show. For those of you just joining us, you are listening to Swords in Space. Today our topic is Isaac Asimov and Robert Silverberg's Nightfall, and I'm discussing that with my guest, Mark Ratush. Before we wrap up our discussion of Nightfall, any further thoughts that you'd add, something from the novel that you wanted to talk about that we haven't touched on?
Well, I think we basically more or less covered everything. I mean, it is a sort of very straightforward plotted. I think we certainly covered we touched upon the philosophical, some theological aspects, sort of the atheistic viewpoint that essentially Asimov is sort of trying to bring through. But still, on the whole, I think as a novel, it does work, and certainly better than a short story, because it certainly fleshes out a lot more. So it's certainly worth a read. Keep, again, any Catholic listener, keeping it in mind. And it's something can be enjoyed, and sort of can keep going back to it and back to it. Because of, so again, those elements of sort of almost like it's a psychological thrill. Thinking, okay, what would it be like in this particular place? No lights and everything else. How would I in a certain situation handle that? Or could we handle that? Or if we go into something stressful, how are we going to come out in an apocalyptic age or post-apocalyptic age? So,
mm-hmm.
So always very interesting.
All right. Well, thank you for a very interesting discussion on the novel. We always close out the show with a segment that I call Event Horizon, talking about new or upcoming events in the science fiction fantasy world. I think we've covered a lot of it in most recent shows, but since I've got you on here, and I know we're both Star Trek fans, I'm going to return to that trough again for some material for this segment. No doubt you've heard about Disney's purchase of the Star Wars franchise and their hiring of J.J. Abrams, who did the reboot of Star Trek, to do Episode 7, and apparently they've got Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, and Harrison Ford all signed on for at least cameo appearances. I imagine it wouldn't be much more than cameos given the state of their careers. As a lifelong Star Wars fan such as myself, what are your thoughts on these developments?
Well, I think it's probably myself and everyone else. I think Disney, considering all the everything they've done to the movie, they're taking over Star Wars. Oh, my God, the merchandising, what are they going to do? We thought Ewoks were bad. And just seeing some of the fan-made trailers of Episode 7 sort of makes you really kind of wonder where this is going to be going.
Disney's done well with the Comic Act adaptations, though.
That they have, but in terms of a larger screen, I'm thinking big bucks. Are they going to be in the same vein as George Lucas basically selling out? I'm surprised that Harrison Ford is actually even considering a cameo appearance. He did not even want to be in Return of the Jedi. More stuff I've been reading up on Star Wars. And he doesn't even want to talk about it on interviews. So the fact he's actually considering coming back, maybe he's broke, maybe he needs a few dollars, I don't know. And considering how old everyone else has gotten, would it be really good to more or less bring them back? I guess it really depends on who we're going to have directing it, who's going to be writing the material.
Yeah, well, it's J.J. Abrams. I don't know, did you see the Star Trek reboot? Because you're a big Trek fan, too.
Yes, I'm very much a classic fan, and I didn't like The Next Generation, and I'm with all those people who thought Abrams' reboot is a load of crap. Star Trek is dead. Star Trek is dead for me. It's over. It's gone. It was something I enjoyed, But certainly as a traditional Catholic, I even look back at the classic series and I cringe. I mean, there's some good stuff in the movies, but sort of take it bits and pieces here and there as a cultural icon. But it's very difficult to go back and watch without sort of, oh, boy. But I figure, I was a kid. I didn't know any better.
Well, I mean, that's perhaps a whole other can of worms, but I'm going to go there briefly because we've got a show coming up in 2 weeks where I'm going to be discussing with Stephen and Brian Paul's a recurring guest, the newest Star Trek movie that's coming out in a couple weeks. So personally, I didn't mind the Abrams Star Trek. To me, it didn't really feel like a Star Trek movie. It was like a pretty decent science fiction action adventure film, but just dressed up in Star Trek. But it didn't really feel like a Star Trek film.
Interesting. Well, see, everything I basically read of it, I guess Jaden had a real love affair with lens flare. Everything was so bright on the bridge, and just in terms of some of the cinematography. In that respect, ship design, most of the things I've read, people just absolutely hate it. But again, it's probably the stuff I'm reading about is basically we're sort of the old hardcore ones. We like the original Enterprise. We love the refit, which is still probably my favorite starship, the most beautiful ship that's ever been out there. But again, it's something after Star Trek VI and Discovery Country, I really couldn't get into anything more. It really depends on the individuals.
You're talking about NCC-1701 Alpha?
No, the NCC-701 that came out in Star Trek The Motion Picture, the first refit rather than opposed to the second one, which they're pretty close. But I take a look at that, and I can sort of watch over that particular movie where it sort of pans over the Enterprise and realize, this is, even though it was dull at the time, that's still a movie I can go back to and watch over and over and over again, even though just for those particular parts, just because it's just an absolutely gorgeous-looking starship. In terms of the plotting and everything else, again, I think it comes to the individual. There's some people who still would like to go out and see a Star Trek movie. I would like to see Star Wars. I think there's a lot more to work with there because it's a much more expanded universe. Yeah. But then it's sort of the hesitation. Okay, Abrams, but of course Disney. Oh boy.
Yeah, but could Abrams really be worse than Lucas uncaged without anyone holding him back, as in episodes 1, 2, and 3?
No, I think we'll see. Lucas shouldn't have had. He just keep him in the background. Someone else should have written and directed. Because he's taking creative control of it, and the fact that even Lucas said he doesn't even know how to write dialogue, and that was sort of a major. I mean, the acting was just atrocious in a lot of the first part of the first three.
Those are good actors, though. So it's the directing, not the actors. But we'll see. But I think Abrams is a better director, and as we always said, the best Star Trek best Star Wars rather was the one that Lucas had the least to do with, being The Empire Strikes Back. So.
Oh yes, that's by far the best. Yep.
maybe we'll get lucky again, but we're getting rather far afield here, and we're right up against the end of our show in any event. So, thank you to our listeners. You've been listening to Swords in Space on the AMDG Radio Network. Our topic was Nightfall, written by Isaac Asimov and Robert Silverberg. And our guest tonight was Mark Ratush, and I'm very grateful to have him with us again. And
thank you very much.
I've been Nicholas Wansbutter of Swords in Space, and you can find me, of course, at www.swordsandspace.com. And although I'm not a big fan of Facebook, everyone else in the world seems to be, so please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/swordsandspace. And, of course, check out blogtalkradio.com/AMDG. We've now been joined by another show on that network, that debuted just a couple weeks ago, that being the Culture of Comics, spearheaded by my good friend Stephen Heiner. as I was saying to the chaps who run AMDG Radio, given that these are the first two shows, maybe we should have called it Geek Radio instead of AMDG Radio. But I encourage you to check that show out as well if you're interested in comics or wanting to learn more. And please join us next week on Swords in Space. I'll be joined by a couple old friends of mine from back in Winnipeg, where I used to live, to discuss my, advice with writing for being my favorite hobby, the tabletop war game Warhammer 40,000. So we'll be giving you a bit of an intro and talking about why it's a great hobby next week. And then the week after that, I'll be with Stephen and Brian talking about Star Trek Into Darkness. So hope to have you with us then. And I'll leave you with some more Handel.